to deal with the background of the contract system on the marketplace to show you that the market has not always been law. And I put up this division of law and discipline and said, law only comes in the history of our rise to consciousness when there's time. And the first act of the courts, therefore, in ancient times was to reserve litigation for cases after a death had occurred. There was plenty of time because the death already led to a standstill by itself. Now I plan to go on today in this manner, but I want to postpone this for next week for the simple reason that I got hold of the decisions of the Supreme Court with which we have to deal in the end, and I cannot hold them for more than today. They are very strict over there. And I have not forgotten my train of thought, and you will kindly still keep in mind this duplicity that there are two worlds in which we live every minute: the law of the order of law and the order of discipline. And this is forgotten today. This is an indisciplined country mentally. I think practically, when you look at the post office and you look at the street discipline, we have a very highly developed discipline. But it doesn't enter your mind to think about this fact that this is not a country of individualists but of fellow men. Tovarish is much more noted in this country than in any other country. And that's why I think Bolshevism cannot make a very great impression on us. People are much more comrades here than they are individualists. And that is always our whole literature, however, is based on the French tradition of individualism, on the French Revolution, and the true American mentality in all your literature and in all your courses is therefore overlaid by this, what I call the pseudo-European American, by which you are completely paralyzed. When I came to this country, I established courses on true Americanism because I felt that all my colleagues in philosophy, sociology, psychology used patterns as you see now from Mr. Freud, who have nothing to do with the American experience. They are all pseudo. Because the problem of voluntary discipline in this country is so essential for every moment of our behavior, you never know this. Take the beeline, I mean take the in the queue in queuing up at a post office. You will find no other country in which it is done with such good grace and such good taste. And so it is an essential experience and an essential law of human behavior in this country that there is a realm of discipline which brooks no delay of the law. And we said, you see, if you would kindly keep in mind this formula, discipline is indispensable where there is no time. For example, on a highway, on a freeway, you see, without discipline, the whole thing breaks down. You can't go to the police court. When you go, there's an accident. I mean, that's already, you see, discipline has been broken. And since all your philosophy in political science and so seems to me pseudo-American, seems to me an article of import about rugged individualism, when all this country has lived by comradeship and mutual help, that I have to go back and show you the further steps of the history of our laws all over the world and this gradual experience that even labor and education may reach the point where legislation has to step in, but also obviously only under very peculiar conditions. And we are just entering a phase of perhaps 400 or 500 years in which this problem that not the marketplace makes law and not the contract between voluntary parties, but the fate of masses will occupy our attention. And so forget about China and about Russia, they are quite unimportant issues. The important issue is whether the United States will find an American language for its American problems. It hasn't found it as yet. In order, however, to lead up to this, now with my legal history in the present, in the last 60 years, let me read to you from the sources the poetry of decisions. When an historian goes to the sources are never histories themselves. You think going back to the sources means to go back to an historian. Perhaps behind the textbook to somebody else who wrote it somewhat longer history, you see. This is not going back to the sources at all. And I please want you to bear with me when I now read, as though I was an old chronicler, from the sources certain documents which lead up to this strange situation today, which we have, that the courts are concentrating on the problem, how can masses come under law? Because we said, by definition, a man belongs to the mass as in as far as he has no time, in as far as he is pressed for time. There is a famous quotation to this purport from Old English. Perhaps you take this down, that's much older than our lifetime. Necessitous men are not truly speaking free men. Necessitous men, very old word, necessitous men, T-O-U-S. Necessitous men are not truly speaking free men, but to answer a present exigency will submit to any terms that the crafty may impose upon them. Necessitous men are not truly speaking free men, but to answer a present exigency will submit to any terms that the crafty may impose upon them. Vernon, well, the special second Eden, 110, that's an old law, collection of law cases, it isn't important, only it's very long ago indeed. Necessitous men are not truly speaking free men, but to answer a present exigency will submit to any terms that the crafty may impose upon them. So here is a special life situation of the wards of law, that is, of those who have no time. And you can imagine that the problem of the union then was to represent this lack of time by creating a surplus of time. The union has time. The man doesn't have to quit work to find a new place. The union finds it for him. He doesn't have to stand in the office bargaining and saying, I come tomorrow, I think it over. But the union thinks it over for him. So he can go to work and not miss a payday, which he cannot afford, because he has to bring home the pay envelope, and therefore in the meantime somebody else has to take out time to stand there. And in this history of the unions, it has always been the simple case of wasting time that has been a part of the negotiating tactics. It's nearly like Mr. Gromyko. You had to have the longest possible cigar, you had to pick it out very carefully, and offer it to your adversary at the union, at the bargaining table. And then people would sit there for 18 hours, 26 hours, smoking each other out. Now, don't laugh. This is actually true. That's why I could never be in a union secretary, because I don't smoke cigars. They make me ill. Then you can't become a union secretary. It's a special humanity which you have to have, or inhumanity, because it is not an accident. Please allow me to make you attentive. The habits and morals of the negotiators are always reflecting the real situation. The fact that these people dally and spend 3, 4, 5 days, you see, in protracted negotiations, when the thing could be settled in 5 minutes, because both know the outcome usually in advance, how many pennies one will yield and how many pennies the other will accept, it's all in the cards. But the thing wouldn't be a collective bargaining process if this, which is not in the power of the workers, would not be established as within the powers of the union, and that's time. Man is a remarkable symbolic and liturgical animal. Things have to find expression. And anybody who wants to play, write a play like The Waterfront, I recommend to him highly that he should dramatize the time element in this situation. Since a worker has no time, labor must gain time. And this is not a paradox, but where you shorten it on one side, the agent whom you create has to stress the opposite side. It's endless time. Endless time, allegedly, of course, there never is. But it is the fiction that these union secretaries cannot be moved out of their tranquility. Another day and another day of negotiation. You hear so often in the papers that the arbitrator in the middle says no comment, you see. No progress made, you see. Nobody knows why. Just because it would not be undiplomatic to yield in the first day. That cannot be done. There have to be protracted negotiations. The word protraction, so to speak, has a kind of sanctity in the ritual of labor negotiations. I agree, I think so. Why protracted? A normal person cannot understand it. But if you were in the plight of a worker, you would feel that he must see that his negotiators have this what he has. They wouldn't believe in the workers, their secretary, if he wouldn't stand back and not deal right away. It cannot be done like this as a bargain, you see, in 5 minutes at auction. It has to be protracted, and I recommend to you this term protracted as meaning the overemphasis to that which the worker and labor and any necessitous man just hasn't got. I once more have here, first as my first choice, the Merchant Marine Act hearings of 1936. I gave you the number already, S3500 and S4110. And if you ever begin to read these documents of the Congress, you will never buy again fiction stories. Certainly not science fiction, because that's much more entertaining than fiction. To prove this to you, I first want to read you one surprising paper. Resolution number 51 of the Seamen's Union, submitted to the Congress of the United States. Now, listen well, whereas the vast majority of the population of the United States is of racially Nordic descent, and here, and many of the youth of the nation would, under proper conditions, seek the sea for a living. And whereas, in prehistoric and early historical times, the inhabitants of northern Germany and the Scandinavian countries were in blood, in social organization, and in religion, a unity which recognized no hereditary bondage, and whose seamen knew nothing of bondage for themselves, and they developed a sea power which assisted the Egyptians, the Carthaginians, and later on the Romans in dominating the Mediterranean. And whereas they also dominated the Baltic, the North Sea, and the Bay of Biscay in the latter part of the reign of Charles the Great, and for about 200 years after his death. And whereas individuals of the sea profession were then eligible to and sometimes received the golden spurs of knighthood. And whereas Christianity, in its struggle against slavery, had succeeded in abolishing chattel slavery, master and servant laws, however, held a large proportion of the people to the soil and to their employers. And whereas changes in the Rhodian law of the sea, the people of Rhodes being big ship owners, you see, had a special law which was then taken over by the Romans, whereas changes in the Rhodian law modified the system of laws governing seamen to what became known as the consulate of the sea, and whereas the introduction of the master and servant laws made of the seamen under the consulate of the sea and the laws of Wisby, children of the ship, very good expression, perhaps you take this down, children of the ship, it shows you how men becomes a ward, a child, you see. As children of the ship, and under the laws of Oleron, they became companions of the ship, thus gradually making the seamen more and more subject to bondage, which was further extended in France by the king, who issued a rescript establishing what is now known as the Inscrit Maritime. This system of bondage was then further extended into England by laws subjecting the seamen on the pain of penal servitude to carry out any contracts made even in British ports and later adopted into the laws of the United States by the First Congress through the act which became known as the Fugitive Seaman's Law. And whereas this gradual loss of the seaman's freedom and the gradual lessening of the seaman's independence made it impossible for them, held in the shackles of their status, to follow the upward trend of human society, resulting from the abolition of slavery and serfdom, and whereas the gradual deterioration of the seaman's life and income made it impossible for them to marry, and thus utterly destroy their social status, and whereas these facts so influenced the population of the United States that boys, youth, and men shunned the sea to such an extent that the United States did not have a sufficient number of native seamen to man its merchant marine and its navy, and had become dependent upon other nations' seamen, both for the merchant marine and the navy, to a very large extent. You remember the story of the Alabama, where there was not one American seaman on this battleship, upon other nations, and had become dependent upon other nation seamen, both for the merchant marine and the navy, to a very large extent, prior to the passage of the Seaman's Act. And whereas the Seaman's Act so changed the public opinion that boys and youth of America birth came in the sea, to the sea in such numbers, that in 1919, when the census was taken, it was ascertained and definitely proven that 51% of the men serving in the then merchant marine of the United States were of native birth. And whereas the United States, desirous of a proper share in the world's carrying trade and the development of a sea power reasonably capable of proper and necessary service in peace and war, is now expending millions each year in the building and operating of American ships, which as yet are largely manned by officers and men insufficiently trained to give efficient service and to restore and maintain safety at sea. And whereas the basis of all sea power is skilled and courageous seamen, the development of which is as yet largely neglected by the United States. Whereas among the purposes for which the International Seamen's Union of America was organized are the development of a native body of skilled seamen in sufficient numbers to give efficient service in peace and war and to restore to the seamen their true status in human society, therefore be it resolved that we favor the legal prohibition of anyone being engaged as a boy, youth, or man on board an American vessel in an American harbor, unless he is a citizen of the United States or capable of becoming a citizen under existing laws. Now that's directed against the Chinese, who were, you see, under the Oriental Exclusion Act, cannot become citizens, and therefore, if nobody can be hired who cannot become a citizen, Chinese cannot be hired. I won't go on with the details, but it is important that you understand that the Seamen's Union has all the time claimed that the American seamen will not work side by side with Orientals or with other people of low status, and that therefore this is not a complaint about working conditions of myself as a seaman, which are under discussion. But it is the neighborhood, the comradeship with people of utterly different ways of life. Today, you see, the percentage of Americans is, I think, set at 75%. These 25%, however, the Seamen Union hold, which are of foreign descent, make all the trouble because the American boys and girls will not work at the same, you see, at the same activity, at the, and be engaged in the same things, and not eat in the same mess hall as the others. I undersuppress the very interesting details here given, because of course cannot go on forever. But will you notice one very important feature? Originally the seamen were free. Now they are in bondage. We have here the American, very patriotic, very Nordic, and very racial and very dangerous version of the communist ideology that primitive society did not know of serfdom, did not know of classes, and which is true, nomads have no classes. Everybody is a warrior, and therefore everybody is equal. You get only classes after settlement. And therefore, the program of all any socialist party in the whole world has ever contained one paragraph saying there should be studies published on primitive society to support the claim, you see, of the masses today that serfdom is not necessary, that there existed once a paradisiac state of affairs in which, you see, men was free and equal, and therefore primitive society is a projection of the future goal of the modern masses into the past. Now, it is very interesting that this president, Fourses is his name, of the Siemens Union, very cleverly avoids all comparison with any communist ideology. But because he wants to avoid the slightest suspicion that he is borrowing a leaf from the communist tradition in going back to primitive society, he makes this very dangerous and very truly ironical loan in the Hitler ideology, from the Hitler ideology. People have to be Nordic, you see, and Scandinavian and Germanic descent, the original seamen, and they helped the Carthaginians and the Egyptians to conquer the Mediterranean. That's, of course, just blatant nonsense. But the nonsense is important, and don't despise it. Today there are only two ways of heralding a claim against the capitalistic or industrial or ruling classes in the world. Either it is all primitive society that already has established the modern case of communism, you see, or it is at least the ancestry, as the English said, Magna Carta freedom, you see, before the Norman conquest, which has to be invoked as our individual past. All revolutionaries invoke a universal past of mankind. All counter-revolutionaries, you can take this down as an important law, all counter-revolutionaries invoke a limited national past within certain frontiers. You see, that the Persians were once this and this is a counter-revolutionary claim. That all men once were born free and equal would be a revolutionary claim. And you find this all over the world now, and you find the funny things that people, by the ups and downs of revolutionary movements today, are forced in various countries to make fascist claims, because counter-revolutionary fascists, of course, the same, you see, because they want to make revolutionary claims, but cannot under the conditions of in their country. So I think it is very unfortunate. But you see how the masses in this country, quite regardless of program or party line, are forced to make themselves understood in a society which has lived by the law of the marketplace, to invoke conditions that pre-existed before the marketplace was the only place from which all law of contract, you see, between partners, buying and selling, was established. At stake is the question, is labor a commodity that is sold over the counter? That's the marketplace ideology. And that's under today, as you know, the battle that is waged, how far all the remnants of this superstition that labor is a commodity can be eradicated from the laws. The sooner the better. Labor has nothing to do with commodities in the marketplace. The wife of the worker may go to the marketplace and buy meat, but when he enters a factory, he is perhaps selling out, but he certainly is not selling a commodity. He is entering a discipline, that's all. Like a soldier, like a seaman on board ship. He's a child of the ship, he's a member of the crew, he is a companion of the ship. All these expressions show to you that he is remembered, that he is put into, you see, a body as a limb. That has nothing to do with selling. And by, and I had already to rant to get angry with you because you said selling and buying was in education also. There was a seller's market in education or buyer's market in education. Wherever you use these dreams of the marketeer, I mean, you are on the verge of driving the country to destruction. The marketplace is one of the four houses of men. The other is the fortress, the third is the temple, and the fourth is the dancing green. The youth has to meet on the dancing green. The marketplace is only the connection with the outside world. It's fourth range. New York is not the most important city of the United States. It's a big port where all the nonsense comes in. This overvaluation of the marketplace, which is one fourth of the organized society, is therefore the reason why these poor people, the unions, are driven to these ideologies of stating that there has been a world before the marketplace. Now, I do feel that all people in distress project their demands too far. That's why I propose to show you that there have been legal orders before the marketplace that aren't so far away. They are only, it was only 400 years ago that we lived in a different order. And these projections here go too far. All people who are starved for justice go too far. When nobility was arrogant, people said Adam and Eve had no nobility, you see. Because it was the one thing they could invoke, so to speak, the primitive state of men. That played a great part in the arguments against the gentry of England in the 18th century. And so I beg you to consider the poetry and the importance of this document. Here you have on American soil, in purely American language, carefully avoiding all assimilation of foreign doctrines. Exactly the same problem. How to evoke in the citizens of the United States the understanding that the existing legal order is not the only thinkable order. That there are perhaps, you see, orders that have gone on before with great and have been very profitable because they concentrated on quite different issues. And as I promised you, we will come back to this. As a crowning of the course, because it will argue better against communist infiltration than any defense by the old men of the Supreme Court of the existing abuses. But it is important that the helplessness of the masses is such that in this year of the Lord, 1936, the only thing they could think of was the antecedents of 2000 BC. I think that's very touching. It shows you, you see, the complete despair to make themselves understood in the present schools of law and of thought of this country, which are all based on this short-sightedness, as though ever the family, children's rights, apprentices' rights, production, the farming could have ever ruled by the laws of the marketplace only. Wherever people had no time, another law had to provide order and discipline. So I feel that if you would include the seaman's fate in this country, the ups and downs of the sea merchant marine, you would already be on the way for an independent judgment of the whole capital and labor question. Because the seaman's fate on board ship has absolutely nothing to do with the Industrial Revolution, you see. And for this reason, you can only say that the Industrial Revolution has improved the situation, mitigated it, because if a man is on board ship now for 6 days, of course he is not in the terrible position he used to be when he was on board ship for 9 months, you see. So everything is in favor of the seaman today through the machine. He has not been created into his bondage and to his childhood on the of the ship by the modern conditions. But that's from time immemorial. And I think that's the great value of starting thinking about labor, not in the trite forms of the modern commonplace. I've never seen capital, I've never seen labor. The only thing I've seen is a woman in labor. I mean this, these obstructions of labor and capital you should try to avoid. You should try to see much more concretely a peculiar situation before dabbling in social reforms. I do not believe that labor and capital exist. They exist in engineers. They make life miserable for the worker. The real fight is today between the engineer and the worker, because the engineer arranges the work in such a way that the worker becomes a puncher. He becomes a cock on the wheel. So I would think that the real conflict in modern industry is between the engineer and the stoker in front of the furnace, for example, you see. Because he is condemned by the thinking of the engineer to do less reasonable acts all the time. The engineer splits any human activity into, you see, innumerable little things, and so the man becomes less and less responsible, less and less interested in his activity. That has nothing to do with the employer. That's the engineer's cunning. So I've always heard that there are four people who make up the worker's question. The worker in the workshop, the engineer in the designing office, is the salesman who goes out to sell, and the manager who mediates between these three other people. There's a book for sale of mine in the library, in the bookstore, which may help you to understand this problem, the multiformity of men, it is called, and tries to break through this cliché that the conflict of the industrial system is between capital and labor. I have never believed this. I've been a factory myself. I've published a factory paper. I've trained union secretaries. I have founded a school for them. I've founded a school for business executives and so on. And I've never found it. So there are four people and they're all combating each other. And the conflict is very serious, but the worst conflict at this moment, for example, of automation, is between the engineer and the worker. And that's, of course, true on board ship with the discipline of the captain and the men at the rudder and the first engineer down at the bottom of the ship. There is the rudder. You can be very highly paid and yet a slave, and you can be very underpaid and yet a free man. Payment has very little to do with it. Certainly our farmer sense in the village in 200 years ago, they're freer than the poor man in a factory today is who has a carrier. Now we come to the famous decisions of the Supreme Court trying to understand that labor is not a commodity. There are three decisions which I wish to quote. The first is still as late as 1922. It's a famous Atkins case. Atkins versus Children's Hospital. And the question before the House was, before the court was, that in the District of Columbia, the Congress itself, who is the legislator of the district, as you know, had passed a minimum wage law and had held that there should be no chiselers who underpaid women in the District of Columbia and thereby competed unfairly with employers who paid decent wages. Now, on board ship, you see, we saw the problem was maximum payments to the seaman at any one time, so that he might not be cheated out of it by the crew, you remember. This is a new notion which I recommend to you. Not maximum wages, but maximum payments are the social problem we have for the worker. If he gets too much at once, he's ruined. And this notion is nowhere in your books, so you take it down, it has to become on our books. As I told you, the seamen helpers have struggled in vain for making modern men understand that to get too much at once may be, you see, a crime to this man. And so maximum payments was the seamen's problem. With the women, it is the opposite, it is minimum payments. And there has been a battle over 15 years about the minimum wage to be paid to a woman who is willing to rush in and do work if she only gets 10 cents just to get something to aid the household. And women are necessitous people who submit to nearly any condition. I read you this phrase, you see, a few minutes ago. And of course they come under this same classification of necessitous men. Now, however, undaunted, the Supreme Court of the United States held, in this case, Atkins versus Children's Hospital, October term 1922, volume 261 of the United States Reports. A highly poetical volume. We cannot accept the doctrine that women of mature age, sui juris, that is, independent, require or may be subjected to restrictions upon their liberty of contract, which could not lawfully be imposed in the case of men under similar circumstances. To do so would be to ignore all the implications to be drawn from the present-day trend of legislation as well as that of common thought and usage by which woman is accorded emancipation from the old doctrine that she must be given special protection or be subjected to special restraint in her contractual and civil relationships. This scorn heaping on injury is really the greatest scandal of this decision. I myself had two sisters, both suffragettes, but one was socialist inclined, the other liberal. And one of these sisters, the older school, the 19th century school, I might call her, for this reason, held that there could be no limitations of women's employment or protection as to working hours at night, you see, or more than 8 hours, because he had to claim equality with men. And they would be, you see, all the men would say, ah, look at the woman if they ask for special protection. Now it is a fact that women are, fortunately, more intimately connected with the course of our creation through their body than men. And that the periods of their life are as rhythmical as tide, ebb and tide. And to make women work at night in their season is a crime against their well-being. My socialistic sister understood this because she cared for the women and not for equality. She had not the abstract notion of an intellect here working up, you see, in men and wife and men and women, but she cared for the people who suffered. So she felt had no took not issue with the ordinance which tried to protect women from night work. And there was this clash in the family. 19th century liberal, women have to be equal because they form a public, you see, here of in your mind. Think of the abolitionists, you see, think of the prohibitionists. And so a liberal cannot understand how the same woman who asks equality in voting rights can ever get up and say, but I cannot do exactly the same kind of work as a man. So she felt that might jeopardize. Now the court of the Supreme Court asked to protect these poor women against the abuses by chiselers, by extortionists, has the effrontery to hold against the women who claim this protection, you see, that at the same time other women claim equality before the law in politics. And I think this is really, something that you should remember, that the Supreme Court stopped at nothing for remaining in this antediluvian layer of geological justice. She must be if you cannot ignore all the implications to be drawn from the present-day trend of legislation as well that of common thought and usage, by which woman is accorded emancipation from the old doctrine that she must be given special protection or be subjected to special restraint in her contractual and civil relationship. One deals, you see, century has to deal with the real person, the real body of this person and soul, and the other deals with this person's mind. And these are just two worlds of mine. And that's why, to this day, you see, the world is in two camps. It is not necessary, but it is. Because the laziness of the human mind seems to be without limitations. So, of course, the minimum wage law passed by the Congress of the United States was thrown out by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional in 1922. We come to the second volume, that's 1935. In 1935, the Supreme Court had the same case to decide with regard to a minimum wage law in the state of New York. And there's a remarkable event that it's a famous case, Moorhead versus New York. Moorhead versus New York, its relationship to DiPaolo. It's a very famous case for anybody who has studied the law. The dominant issue in that case was whether Congress had power to establish minimum wages for adult women workers in the District of Columbia. The Atkins case, which I just read you. Now it comes again, you see, and the majority of the Supreme Court judges as late as 35 has held that the Atkins case made law, and that Scarlett A. Seasies is a famous saying, you see, you have to abide by the precedent and nothing can be done. That's the great dawn of justice. There are four dissenting judges against five who decide the case as to precedent, and one of the judges is the presiding judge Hughes, a Republican candidate for president in 1920, and he says this is nonsense. And the second great dissenter is Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, and the third great dissenter is the future Chief Justice of the United States, Harlan Stone. Now, these three dissenters are, you see, the greatest jurists this country has had, perhaps Justice Brandeis, which did you mention Cardozo, in the last 50 years. So it is very exciting to see that in 35, the balance was so that the four mightiest minds of the United States bar were holding that, of course, a woman could be protected. And the five routine judges held that since this case had been decided in 22, nothing had occurred in the meantime to change their minds. I'm not going to repeat much of the majority decision, but I want to read only one important phrase, because of course that's time and again. What has been said, I think it comes for the last time in the volumes of this court, that labor is a commodity that can be sold over the counter. That's of course the point at issue, from the point of view of the jurors. Now we have seen that the thing isn't so simple. You remember that I supply you with an evidence of which the lawyers have never taken cognizance, that a crimp sold the seaman as a merchandise, as his merchandise, the crimp's merchandise, you see. The middle ground of the 19th century law was that man himself sold his labor as a commodity across the counter in a strange twist of the imagination. And so will you kindly realize the difference? Seaman as merchandise is the law of the crimp, of the crimp. The middle ground, a tenuous balance between the facts and the old contractual thinking is that the worker sells his labor, and there comes in this nonsensical abstraction labor, you see, his labor as a commodity. And now if you watch your own step, you will find that you constantly stumble over this idiotic phrase, because one time labor is my commodity as a worker, and one time it's myself. When you speak of competent labor, then it's the workers, you see. They are the subject. Classified by labor, you see. And the next minute, the judge says, But no, the man is free, of course, at liberty to sell at any minimum wage, you see, without any minimum wage, his labor, like these women, who were told that their liberty was at stake, and if the minimum wage law was upheld, then their liberty was abolished to sell the commodity of their labor, you see, across the counter. You see the paradoxical situation that liberty, the pursuit of life, you see, property and liberty was invoked in order to make it impossible to protect these women, because why shouldn't they be at liberty to sell their commodity with the only thing they had, labor, across the counter? Now, you have never seen, of course, a person who is able to stand at the same time on both sides of the counter, you see. Here is me, I'm selling, and all of a sudden I find myself, you see, on the other side of the counter, carried away to do my work. This is idiotic. But this idiocy has inveigled people who came from the marketplace and held this to be the only way of explaining life as late as 1935. And you have to remind you that you, of course, are thinking exactly the same strain. And if you do not wake up to the fact that this is idiocy, what have you? It is still the American dogma, despite the High Court, despite they have seen the light, but I don't think the public has. Yes, please. Delighted. For the rest of the week, I shall. There are three things workers become. Labor forces, in fact, that is, they enter an arrangement where water, electricity, iron and steel, and they themselves are knitted together in certain engineers' arrangement of forces. And therefore, I in a factory am a force, a useful force, a skilled force, or what you like, but I'm not a person, because I have to fit into a discipline together. You just have to think of the conveyor belt. And I'm paid for abdicating my personality in favor of this discipline. This is what I'm paid for. I'm paid for a change of attitude, just as a woman, when she marries, becomes from a virgin or a girl, a woman and a wife. And that's what marriage is about, that she changes her own state of aggregate, that she is a different type of human being after this day, wedded to a man, and half of his life, that they form a corporation.